David Bowie dances through a dreamland, Eddie Murphy plays his entire family, and Superman returns for what will surely be a new series of successful Bryan Singer movies this week in 30-2010.
30-2010, here we go again. Analyzing decades, sitting with our friends, those were different days. And there's so much to say.
It's time for another look back at what happened this week, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago. That's 1986, 1996, and 2006, the week of June 24th through the 30th. I'm one of your hosts, Brad Elston.
I'm also one of your hosts, Henry Gilbert.
I'm the Goblin King, Dave Rudden.
Hey.
I'm gold medalist Diana Goodman.
And yeah, we will be talking about one of our mutually... some of our favorite movies.
We got some good movies on here.
This is a big movie week. At least, even if they're not some of my favorites, I have very specific personal connections.
Yeah. But before we get into the movies of 1986, there are some news items that we will discuss briefly. June 29th, 1986, Argentina, who we mentioned last week, wins the World Cup 3-2 against West Germany.
Yep. Hey, remember there were two Germanys?
Oh, yeah, two
Germanys. Yes.
Yep. There used to be two Germanys,
only
kids.
They had united, they could have beaten Argentina, but...
kids, yeah. Germany is a...
We used to have countries back when we had corporeal forms.
Yes, and I don't know if you've heard of government, but before... this last year. June 27th, 1986, Don Rogers, a safety for the Cleveland Browns, dies of a heart attack. Oh, I shouldn't have done,
done
the voice.
God, hilarious. Damn.
Dies of a heart attack due to cocaine at age 23, one day before his wedding.
Yeah.
8 days after Lynn Bias.
Well, that Browns joke was good.
I'm editing the show. Maybe I can... I didn't read ahead. Similar promise squandered. Rogers was a co-player of the game in 1983 Rose Bowl and won Defensive Rookie of the Year in his rookie season.
I mean, like, so you can imagine, like, why in 1986 and late 80s, coke is terrible. Don't touch it.
Yeah. Move on to crack.
Two athletes that were, like, just about to hit it big, like, struck down in this... like within 10 days of each other.
That's it's nuts,
like,
man.
And you think, well, they're athletes. They're in great shape. Yeah. I'm a fucking slob. Yeah.
My heart can't possibly.
My heart's already pissed off just from Twinkies. I don't know if I can handle cocaine.
Wow, I didn't know that one came. I had heard all about the Len Bias one. I did not know this one came. The Don Rogers one came so close after it. That's shocking.
Movies this week. Karate Kid 2 is still number one. Passes the 100 million mark in 86. Wow. Makes a lot of money. We talked about it a lot last episode. But the bigger movie for this week, which we... poor David Bowie. Is Labyrinth.
Poor Chris. I apologize that Chris is off on assignment because we got to talk Muppets.
Well, I mean, I'm a big Muppets fanboy as well, so I can back it up too. But so yeah, this was... I mean, we watched this recently because as part of our Monday Night Movie thing because of the passing of David Bowie.
I think a lot of people went back to watch this. People who were kids in the 80s and 90s especially, this is their David Bowie.
And definitely because Bowie was a big deal in the 70s for his music, but to 80s kids, like in the mid-80s, it wasn't like the worst period of his music, but he wasn't great, but he was still a force. And then all these kids see this film directed by Jim Henson, with R.I.P. him as well, but about that stars him as this villain. And
this magical figure.
Yeah,
and he's so weird.
And sexually enchanting figure as well.
Very large cod piece.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, he didn't have a cod piece. It was just like, it's just a snake.
Iman was a lucky lady.
But it starred Jennifer Connelly in a coming-of-age role. It was kind of like a modern Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, yeah. But, that's a good point.
But starring a girl, like, her character was one who read Alice in Wonderland. Like, unlike Alice, who is just bored by things and doesn't want to learn stories or all this stuff, she loves stories. She loves playing the princess or all these fairy tales. And then she falls into one herself, and it's kind of about her growing up through her travel through the Muppety world of the labyrinth she gets lost in. And that's also where she meets Hoggle, with his very complex head, like one of the most complex Muppets, animatronic Muppets they had built.
I mean, he was able to piss. So.
And also Terry Jones wrote the screenplay.
There are some very Monty Python-esque scenes in it here that I didn't really pick up on as a kid, but when they're in like the scary cave and it's like, and she's like, stop it. And like, oh, but we just want to keep doing it. No, stop it. You're not scaring me. Stop it. Oh, can't we just go boo for a little bit? Come on, boo.
I know. There's definitely
so Monty Python.
There's some very Python-y things in there. Yeah. Same with the, I think one of my favorite like bits of...
Sir Didymus is actually pretty Python-y, too, when I think about it.
He's the most Muppety of the people in it, I'd say. But I think, you know, from an artistic level, too, I love the hands, all the hands that, put in different positions to chant. Just amazing.
It's just a beautiful 80s fantasy movie that is kind of targeted at kids, but doesn't talk down to kids.
No.
And it's just a thing that you'll see a lot of in the 80s and then not so much as the years go on, where the whole kid's in peril, where the movie's not afraid to show with no seeming safety net. Mm. Like, oh yeah, this kid could get killed in this weird place away from their family and parents.
He's crawling upside down stairs. And,
It's just it's a cool, weird fantasy movie that also has a great soundtrack and is beautiful to look at.
When I knew several women in my generation who projected themselves into the Connelly role and who, you know, would fall in love with David Bowie through this. And the first clip I have there is just my favorite line of Bowie's in the film.
What have we here?
Nothing. Nothing. Nothing, tra-la-la.
Your Majesty.
So,
nothing, tra-la-la.
Nothing, tra-la-la. So David Bowie plays the Goblin King who kidnaps the annoying little brother of Jennifer Connelly, and she has to follow him into the labyrinth to save him, and he being collected as the power of the babe. And the babe with the power.
Your power.
Power of the babe.
You'll hear it later in the show.
it's a great... It is full of like good Bowie songs, especially if you're a kid who's never heard Bowie songs before. They're great songs. I think my favorite one is the Underground song, which I think is the other clip I have there. Just love it. Yeah, this opens and closes the movie, and
a terrible CGI owl.
Yeah. Hey, for
great sex, I guess.
Oh, that's sex. Kids, you should have been there in the 80s.
It's Labyrinth with David Bowie. Hoggle. And Hoggle.
That voice. Yeah, what a beautiful man.
I love it. So, from a behind-the-scenes standpoint, this was a tough time for Henson. You know, they'd made Dark Crystal previous to this, and it was a mega flop. And so he...
Still never seen it.
He still didn't want to make another Muppet film, but he knew he had to make something at least a little more friendly to audiences that would have... So it was a similar production labyrinth to Dark Crystal, except it had humans in it, so humans could... So the viewer could at least attach themselves to somebody easily, in much more easily. And it had, Bowie's original songs in it to hook you into. And it had a lot more humor than just the, like... dark fantasy of the Dark Crystal. And yet it was still a box office flop. It cost the box office was $12 million, almost 13, cost $26 million.
And you can tell it looks great.
It looks
expensive.
And it was just another one of those moments of like Henson unfortunately learning like people want Muppets from him. They don't want mass people don't want it, even though these are great films or great, you know, the Storyteller series, which would follow this. He'd do all these TV shows. And this was another production out of England as well, too. Like, that's where he was able to get most of his funding. But anyway, Labyrinth, a great film, worth revisiting. I would say it's a really good film. Great is a strong word.
I agree. But, yeah, like, I hadn't seen it until, like, it was on VHS. But I think just, like, because I was so into video games as, like, an 8 or 9 year old, like, this game, this movie is like a game where you're going through a maze.
Yeah. You can go to lasertime.bandcamp.com, and we have, like, all the commentaries we do over those Monday night movies. If you're not a patron, you can go. If you are, you have access to these already. But if you aren't a patron, you can go to Bandcamp and find these for like whatever they cost, but they're not expensive. But it's just us riffing on the movie, watching it live. So if you missed our live,
we barely cry at all.
Yeah,
it was like the day after he died.
Yeah. So if you missed that with when we watched Labyrinth, then you want to hear us talk about it more. You can hear literally the entire movie scene by scene on our Bandcamp page. Also out this week, Running Scared with Billy Crystal.
And Gregory Hunt.
Yeah, it's a cop
Paul Walker
movie.
No, that's 2006.
Oh. Yeah, it's a buddy cop film, and I only saw the trailer. It's crazy to think of, like, so let's try to make Billy Crystal an action star. And so it's him, like, in car chases, him and Gregory Hines, who I think is most famous as, like, you know, a famous dancer on Broadway and star of tons of movies, too. A much better actor than Billy Crystal. My opinion, Billy Crystal's very low. I mean, Billy Crystal's fine at remembering going to Yankee games with his dad. Otherwise, not so great. But
he's great on Clippers commentary, by the way.
I remember watching it. I remember liking it. But I also was a kid at the time.
Yeah. It feels
and
like
there was a sex scene. My parents just never had problems with it. Like, okay, whatever.
And it feels like the type of movie that would have been made like in response to Lethal Weapon, but it's like 3 years before Lethal Weapon. So,
that's weird.
But I mean, buddy cop, obviously it's more 48 hours. Like, let's make 48 hours, but in Chicago with Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines in it instead. And it's weird on the poster, Billy Crystal is like wearing a Chicago Cubs thing shirt because they're in Chicago. I'm like, you're the least Chicago guy he is. Like, you did a Broadway show about how much you love the Yankees.
My favorite thing that Billy Crystal ever did. Also this week, Ruthless People with Danny DeVito, Bill Pullman, Bette Midler.
Okay, this is one I would like to go back and watch because
I've never heard of this.
I have a vague recollection of it.
Seeing like on HBO,
and
or something.
It does sound pretty funny. It does have a very good reputation. Directed by I don't know if it's Zucker Abrams, Zucker or just Abrams or whatever.
Zucker and Abrams.
Yeah, did like Airplane and Naked Gun. Oh. And it starts out, it's kind of like a Ransom of Red Chief thing, where it's like Danny DeVito and Bette Midler are a rich couple, and Judge Reinhold and I'm forgetting the girl who plays Supergirl are like this poor couple, and they're going to kidnap Bette Midler and hold her for ransom. Helen Slater, thank you. But at the same time, it turns out Danny DeVito, he was going to kill Bette Midler too, so he doesn't give a shit she's been kidnapped. And they keep like, how about $1 million ransom? He's like, nah, we'll give her back for $500,000, man. And don't call the cops. Like, no, and I'm going to call the cops now and the media. And it's like they can't give her away. They're just stuck having kidnapped her. And I think I looked it up recently. I think it's Bill Pullman's first movie too. He's a goofy guy, mixed up. It's all kinds of, everyone gets double crossed and all kinds of craziness happens. And
I think I remember the VHS box that has like them in duck masks or something kidnapping her. I could be misremembering, but
it sounds potentially very, very dark, but it's supposed to be pretty funny.
And then American Anthem.
Right.
I had to look this up. It stars Mitch Gaylord.
Mitch Gaylord.
But what, playing himself? Or like it's the story? Okay, but it's...
He was a gold medal athlete in 84.
And he's playing a gymnast. Or it's a football player turned gymnast who seeks to join the United States Olympics team. And Gaylord was a member of the U.S. Olympic team in 1984. And he would win, he got a Razzie nomination for Worst New Star, but he lost it to the six guys and gals in the duck suit of Howard the Duck.
That's not fair.
This director would go on to do Tango and Cash after this.
That's
a movie.
Yeah, though actually
I guess scenes of it.
That's the thing. Tango and Cash was that. Let's talk about Tango and Cash for a second.
No.
It was a very troubled production where...
Not for 3 years, Henry.
Stallone was way more powerful than anybody else on the set, so he's just like, you know what, fuck you. I'm filming the rest of this. Like, it's my movie now. He fired the... director of photography, all these people.
I feel like we don't have, when we do put professional athletes into movies as stars anymore, they don't go theatrical.
Yes. Yeah.
they go to Sci-Fi Channel, and it's, you know, supposed to be cheap and supposed to be a goof.
They gotta work their way up from there.
Yeah, we don't ever try like earnestly try. Yeah. Like, this guy was a really popular hockey player, so let's make an action movie for him.
Let's create Gymkhana for this guy.
Jesus. Boy, what a, that's a fantastic mm-hmm. movie. TV this week, though, very important.
Dashing and daring, courageous and caring, faithful and friendly with stories to share.
I'm going to deny you the chorus.
Dare you. We get the Alicia Keys version, at least?
Marching along as their song fills the air. Gummy bears bouncing here and there and everywhere. High adventure that's beyond compare. They are the gummy bears.
Didn't watch the show.
So
putting those sound effects in during the song bugs me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that either. But so this, 1986, no anime corner this week. Instead, on a on the shallow waters of television, I went to look what was on Saturday morning cartoons at the time. We already talked about Droids.
Yes. Mm.
And so one of the only other, like, actual notable ones that wasn't just like, oh, it's the third season of the Snorks. Like, who cares? But the premiere of Disney's Adventures of the Gummy Bears, which 86 was a bad time for Disney and Disney animation in particular. Michael Eisner was the new guy in charge and he was trying to rebuild. And he had started Walt Disney Animation Television, the production arm of Disney that would make cartoons for TV. And this would be the first one. And Eisner apparently came up with the idea of this, saying, like, my kid loves these gummy bear candies. Make a thing about that. So it's a family of cutesy multicolored bears who bounce around and kind of have the Smurfs idea of their, they have a mystical thing that a guy wants to take and they live in the middle of the woods. And but their secret is gummy berry juice, not Smurf berries or whatever. So very different.
Oh, yeah.
But it started, so it's really also important, even though most kids don't remember it, it was not that big. It's remembered as the beginning of Disney Afternoon, because Disney got into producing their own shows with this for animation for television, and they wanted to get enough to syndicate it, but they were held to the production of Saturday morning cartoons, which was 13 episodes a year. So they produced 13. It took them 4 years to get to the magic number that they could syndicate in afternoons with. And so once they were in the middle of that, they're like, this is taking forever. Screw it. The next one we do, we're going to just spend a huge amount of money and produce all 52 episodes we have to produce to syndicate it and just release them all at once. Like, basically do 3 years of production on a thing and then put it out to air in reruns forever. And so that would be DuckTales that would follow it in 89, I believe it was DuckTales premiered. But Gummy Bears got that started. And DuckTales would follow into Tailspin, would follow into...
Hold on. Rescue Rangers was next.
Sorry, Rescue Rangers, then
then
Tailspin,
it was Tailspin.
Then Darkwing Duck.
And then who cares?
Then Bonkers.
What about Goof Troop? Wasn't that...
Goof Troop. Yeah, actually, it was Goof Troop before Darkwing Duck and Darkwing.
No, I think
Bonkers.
It was Darkwing, Goof Troop, and then Bonkers.
Okay, yeah. All right.
But by Bonkers, I was like... And then still watching it because I had nothing else to do.
Bonkers was originally pitched as a Roger Rabbit animated series, but they couldn't do it.
It would have been cool.
Would have been much better with him. But
this is one of those shows I remember seeing on this early, like 86, 87, and just not really watching it because it didn't really grab me. And then after DuckTales was out, they would start packaging this in with the Disney Afternoon, which...
Yeah, they produced one episode of 13 seasons that was original for Disney Afternoon once it launched, but then after that, the Gummy Bears ended. And the only other connection they would have to a later Disney animated series would be Gargoyles, the 1994 series Gargoyles, which many people thought they only produced to have their own type of Batman animated series because it was Disney animation. It was the Disney Television Animation Group, but they were making a more grown-up series with more mature themes, at least, you know, aimed at the 14-year-old, 12-year-old boys as opposed to the 8-year-old boys like their other shows. And so, but they said, yes, definitely we were influenced by Batman the Animated Series, but we really took the concept of gummy bears and just turned it into a grown-up show because the Gargoyles are also a multicolored group of weird magical creatures who exist in secret and are being hunted by other people who want to steal their magic. It's the same basic concept they started from.
And the yellow bear who has like the mohawk looking hair at the time now looks super in style because that look is so like very 2016.
My favorite, I remember no names of them, but I do. My favorite as a kid was the pink bear because it was the little kid who was obsessed with swords. And he had his like cardboard sword, which I had as a kid too. So it was easy to project myself.
Mm-hmm. Music this week taking us out of 1986, a little less than last. Go listen to last week's episode if you want like 35 minutes of 1986 talk. On my own, still number one, still number one, killing it. This week for music is actually pretty big because the Eurythmics have their album Revenge, which you probably know the song Missionary Man.
Oh, I love that song.
Which is a great song, and I would even normally play out with that. However,
no.
Madonna's True Blue came out this
week,
which is one of her biggest albums. Hits like Open Your Heart, Isla Bonita, Papa Don't Preach, and then True Blue itself was a hit. This was a big transitional album that kind of took her from the squeaky, high-pitched voice of the early 80s and made her into this kind of that controversial Madonna with Papa Don't Preach especially
In 84, in 84 she was kind of seen on the same, she was just like, oh, you're kind of similar to Cyndi Lauper. You're kind of sexual but kind of fun and kind of like New York-y and all that stuff. But then, True Blue is when she started to transition to more of the sex symbol, the self-determined sex symbal that she came
to. Well, the Open Your Heart video is the one
David
where...
Fincher.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, yes,
it
is.
Yeah, where she's basically a stripper and she's wearing pretty much a what's it called?
Like the peep show one with
peep show, the bustier with sequins on her nips, and it is very skimpy.
Express Yourself is the David Fincher one. Never mind.
Yeah, but man, Papa Don't Preach, great song too.
But sold 25 million copies worldwide. Wow. One of the biggest albums. But even that, and I'm a big Madonna fan, especially this era of Madonna. But because I don't know when this chance will ever get to play this song, and we're at the end of June, this month the Crowded House album came out. Crowded House had one of my favorite 80s songs, Don't Dream It's Over. So we'll go out because this is probably the only time this song will ever come up. And there's no
time for Madonna another day.
But we're never going to talk about Missionary Man.
There's still time.
I was born in original
What's anything
sin
to before we go
I
out?
I mean,
it's a great song.
Original sin.
It's a great.
If I had a dollar bill for everything I'd done, I'd have a mountain of money holding up to my chin.
It's great.
There.
Eurythmics, everything. You should check them out.
All right. Next time we do karaoke, I'm doing all in here next.
That's fine. We've also promised an all-metal version, I think, has been promised on this show, too. But what a great time that'll be. Well, Don't Dream It's Over, and we come back, what happened this week, 1996.
Ahoy, hoy, Laser Time Podcast listeners. Have you lost all of your friends by refusing to communicate in nothing but Simpsons references? Well, we're here to help with Talking Simpsons, our chronological exploration of the best television show ever. Here's a highlight from our most recent and beginning discussion.
And I really like Marge's advice for hanging out with Homer, but it does leave me with a question I don't want the answer to.
Well, if you want to get closer to him, then maybe you should bridge the gap. I do it all the time. I pretend I'm interested in looking at power tools, going to those silly car chase movies, and some things I'll tell you about when you're older.
So, fingers and butt. I know that's what you're talking
about. I was going to say butt
stuff. I guess butt stuff. Though I feel like in the more innocent early 90s, she could have just meant blowjobs.
Yeah.
Because we...
we've come.
Worst episode ever.
That's Talking Simpsons every Wednesday on the Laser Time Podcast Network until the show becomes unpopular.
Who gives you raging arcade gameplay? Sega! Who gives you the most authentic sports games? Sega! Who gives you a game that lets you fly? Sega! And who gives you access to the internet on your TV? Sega! Play games, surf the net, only on Sega Saturn. Sega!
Reload!
We've Got the Power. KMFDM, Power, off the album Extort.
So we're in a club scene in a dystopian future.
We certainly are.
There's a really big fan on one of the walls.
Blade the Vampire is about to kill a bunch of vampires.
A lot of, like, dude, if that movie exists, that scene you're describing, there's a KMFDM song within 50 feet of it. Man, KMFDM was one of my favorite bands in the 90s, and I haven't listened to them in about a decade now, but... they were really strong with their sound all the through the early 90s, and this was a period where their prior album in 95, Nile, was great and was way industrial and very 95. This leads a little bit more rock with some industrial in it, and then the next album in 97 is like hard, nasty dance club shit with guitars in it, and then the next one is they had a really good sound that they would bounce from, and the members around the band would kind of change, and the sound would change, but they always had great album art, and this, even when the sound would change, the unified like purpose and voice of the songs and what they were trying to get across. It's very Anarchy 101 and Government is Bad and is Lying to You 101, but it's...
Oh, man, it blew my mind!
I know, but like as a 15-year-old, like it was like, what is this counterculture? And they did a good job of that. So I actually got this album. It came out, I was in Branson, Missouri. And was like, let's go to this comic shop. And then they had CDs there, and I knew vaguely that a new KMFDM album was coming out. And then there it was, and I was like, oh, and listened to this over and over again on
Branson
the way home.
Branson has got
to
be the least KMFDM town in America.
Yes, it certainly is. But this is apparently its best-selling their best-selling album, which I think comes off of the heat of their prior album in 95, because they had songs in the Street Fighter animated movie. Mm-hmm. The Chun-Li Vega fight is the song Ultra. That's the first track on Nile.
Love that song.
They're in the first Mortal Kombat movie, Duke Joined Jezebel, and they were in a lot of just soundtracks at the time. So I think all of that led a bunch of people to discover them, and Drug Against War was on Beavis and Butthead a couple years before that.
Yeah.
So like there was a lot of like sub-mainstream stuff happening with them, and then I think when this album came out, it like exploded. Mm-hmm. And then my favorite album of theirs is the next year, which is called Symbols. And then the next album would come out on April 20th, 1999. You might remember it best for Columbine. And that was apparently sort of intentional, because some of the songs, lyrics of KMFDM were in their notebooks when they shot everybody.
Hey.
And then they released a song after that called Witch Hunt that's about them being blamed for Columbine.
Wow.
So I really, really enjoy this band. Anyway, also, Get Up On and Dance came out this week, which is the Quad Cities DJs album.
Yeah.
Oh.
We already talked about Come On Ride It, The Train. That's single was like in February, and now the album is finally out.
It's a regularly slow train.
If you feel like dancing, well, come on.
But then, movies this week, Nutty Professor.
This was the return of Eddie Murphy. It was his big comeback. He had been in lots of bad films, and a lot of people had written him off as a possible star in things. Like, I think it was the year before, or maybe 2 years before, he was in A Vampire in Brooklyn, the Wes Craven film.
Ooh.
So awful, like really bad. Not to say The Nutty Professor is a great film, but it was totally in his wheelhouse.
Yep.
It let him show off everything he is great at, and show that what an awesome comic he still, a comedic actor, he still was. And so, it's hard to imagine. That's like 20 years ago now.
Wow.
And it's famous for him playing like
the Clumps.
The Clumps, his entire
the Clumps
family.
The Clumps is the worst part. Like, the Clumps
the worst
are funny
thing
in,
to come out of it.
Yes, the Clumps are funny in small doses.
Sure.
But
then they ran with it.
It kind of poisoned his career from then on.
Oh, this is so fabulous. Ain't nothing like getting together with family and having a good meal. Oh, please take this bowl.
It's like comrade.
Damn, Sherman, it's almost like we don't see your ass no more. Good to see you, son.
Yeah, Sherman, you think you two Joe College good to spend a little time with your family every now and then?
Well, I've been real busy with
research, I don't want no potato. You know Matt Tate gave me gas.
It's just the whole...
You didn't even get to the Hercules.
Oh, yes. It's coming.
Okay. You know, in my day, Sherman, people used to spend time with their family on Sundays and special occasion, come around and pay their...
Baby's got a little gas.
I don't know. An exhausting performance from Eddie Murphy 12 times over.
It was an amazing makeup transformation for him. Everybody could not believe the fat suit, just the fat suit they made for the main character in it, for the Nutty Professor, which is a remake of a Jerry Lewis film. It was about a nerd who becomes cool through a drink, not
Hercules,
a fat man.
Hercules,
who,
Hercules, Hercules.
There you go.
Oh, was that one so great, so much better than this Nutty Professor? What's so great about that?
It's different.
It's very different. Eddie Murphy really loves Jerry Lewis.
Yeah.
And it is funny, and I mean, Jerry Lewis is kind of an acquired taste. I like some of his stuff and some of his other stuff. My biggest problem with the original is that he's a professor who wants to date a student.
Mm.
And at least they fixed that one.
That's fine.
That's all right.
Hey, if she's in college.
No, she's in college, but at least they fixed it that, you know.
That's one of the problems
that
we don't have.
It's another
In this one, he's in love with another teacher. Yeah. And it also has the great message of like, no, she'll accept you for being fat. But I could not imagine Eddie Murphy starring in a movie where at the end of it, he falls in love with an overweight woman.
I could not imagine. It doesn't even make sense as a movie.
But then him playing all of the clumps at the dinner table, and him finding a different fat voice for each of them. It's impressive. The film
was released on Blu-ray in 2012, March 6th, to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Universal Studios.
Wow.
That's what they celebrated with?
Yeah, just as a Blu-ray.
This is the highest achievement.
Most farts ever in one movie.
You say that.
You know, Sherman, I think I do remember hearing something on TV about colon cleansing. They say everyone should have one. I'm thinking about getting me an appointment and go down and getting my colon cleansed thoroughly.
You want your colon cleansed? Fine, I'm going to clean mine.
What happened, Neil? You gonna start breaking gas? Don't break gas and destroy our meal.
Don't tell me to stop. You the one that brought up colon cleansing and all that mess.
I did not say anything about breaking gas. I said that I was gonna get my colon cleaned.
You can talk about putting the tube in somebody's ass, but I can't break wind.
Can you believe there's still 40 seconds to go?
This revitalized his career, but also made him think like, oh, every film I have to be in has to have some makeup craziness.
Yeah,
I have
some
to play
physical
eight
gimmick
characters.
To it. Yeah,
and which would, I guess, Norbit is the the lowest point of that. And it torpedoed his ability. Like, he almost won an Oscar.
Yep.
Were it not for Norbit, he probably would have.
Wow!
And he earned it. Like, him in Dreamgirls is great.
He's really good.
He is so good at that.
Nutty Professor made $274 million.
Oh,
wow!
Did really well, and it got a sequel in 2000 that we'll talk about. I'm sure the show will still be on by then. Striptease also came out.
This was a disaster.
It wasn't trashy enough for what it wanted to be.
Yeah.
So it's based on a novel by Carl Hyas, and he was one of my mom's favorite writers, who would write comedic crime books, usually set in Florida, which was fun to read while my mom was living in Florida at the time. Loved all his books, and Striptease was one of them. But then it got the big news that they had hired Demi Moore to star in it.
For a record amount of money.
Yes. And they were paying
her. We're going to check out that Demise, baby.
I know, but it wasn't I don't know. It's Showgirls, at least, they could really push it as that. But it's not even good as titillating garbage.
Well, it has a lot of problems, and I'm sure they went back and they had script problems and they had reshoots. I'm kind of bummed to find out, it was written and directed by Andrew Bergman, who has written a lot of great stuff. Let's start with, how about Fletch, The In-Laws, Blazing Saddles, Soap Dish, one of my favorites.
Oh, wow.
And then this crap. He has a really bad track record as a director.
Yeah.
But it's it tries to be funny, but it tries to be heartfelt. Like, it's all about her and her daughter. That's why she goes into stripping. It's played by one of Demi's real kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Robert Patrick, I think, is in it. And
There's
a point I just remember he's on a ton of drugs, and I'm like, oh my god, he's infected with a bug like Vincent D'Onofrio in Men in Black. It's he's so twitchy and weird, and then people get beaten to death, and they're like, it's funny. Now the strippers are trying to run in their high heels, and you're like, this isn't funny. This is horrible.
Yeah, it's
this is what
I feel like. Strip or Showgirls overshadowed this movie, and it came out the year before in like almost every way. It's campier.
Yep.
For 14-year-old Dave at the time, nudity was way better.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know. Yeah, like I remember watching this.
More rewatchable, and at least it's like it knows it. It knows
more what it is doing.
Well, that's the difference in directors too. Like Joe Hesterhaus wrote a shitty script, but who cares?
Yeah, where this movie I find is really interesting is in Burt Reynolds' career. Because Burt Reynolds famously did not want to be in Boogie Nights. He did not like being in Boogie Nights, and he's fantastic in Boogie Nights. Burt Reynolds begged for this role. He was killing himself to be in a movie where he's like standing there in cowboy boots, covered in head to toe in baby oil, I think.
Yep.
And
it
he
was
is
disgusting.
Terrible.
It's so gross. It's so sad. Like, I didn't know he begged for that. I knew that he was like...
He begged for it.
You should be proud of Boogie Nights. Like, Boogie Nights revitalized career, but then he does this shit. And also, it was like he shaved off his mustache. And like, dude, why? We still know it's you. Like,
it's bad. It's just bad.
A really bad movie.
Just
not,
bad.
And again, Showgirls, at least, is like campy and stupid.
It's strange, though. Even the idea of like... I hadn't thought about Showgirls or Striptease until this moment since then. But like, if you weren't old enough or cognizant of what was going on, like, there was just like, I've still never seen either of them, but like, there was this back and forth just in the pop culture miasma of like, this thing was Striptease, what's going on? Like, I thought it was supposed to be good and it's bad. Like, it's just this, everything you said, like, I knew, but I never read this or sought this information out. It was just like, the back and forth between these two movies and like how much is Demi Moore going to show?
Right.
And how much can they really? It's like it
and
was
the
just
idea, like this is going to be the classier one.
Yeah,
like this is the Hollywood one. That other one was just so trashy and gross.
One. Like
and she's getting like $20 million or something for this.
Yeah,
and this is going to be the good one.
Released in the middle of a summer when
horrible.
It's like every movie's a tentpole release and like they were expecting big things. And
this was a tentpole in a different.
Hey Dave, moving on to TV.
All right, so the final episode of Picket Fences aired June 26th. It was a very odd legal drama set in middle America in a town, Rome, Illinois, made-up town, created by David E. Kelley, who was known for making ridiculous TV shows, ridiculous network sitcoms, ridiculous network dramas.
So this is the one before Ally McBeal, then?
Yes, this is pre-McBeal. He'll make McBeal, I believe, next year or the year after. But on the show, most famous actors on it, Tom Skerritt was the lead in it as the sheriff in town. And then Lauren Holly was, I believe, his love interest.
The
who
CG
was,
squirrel
no,
from Ice
No, I don't think she was the love interest.
No, that's right. But
she
Lauren,
was another cop.
Yeah, she was another cop. And one of the lead lawyers was Fyvish Finkel. I love Fyvish Finkel. He is still alive,
but he is of
the era of vaudeville and Yiddish performance,
Yiddish
like live
theater.
Performance. Yiddish theater.
There used to be enough people who spoke Yiddish that you would have a theater for them.
And Fyvish Finkel is his name from the theater. Like that is not that is his stage name, and he won an Emmy for it as well.
It was a very oddball show.
Yeah, actually.
But I enjoyed really liking it.
I have two clips I found of just the commercials to let you know how they sold you on the show, which was just like, what is the crazy case this week?
Returns. An event this big calls for a special guest.
The Pope is coming here.
Oh my God, here he comes.
But a shocking murder leads to a divine witness.
You cannot subpoena the Pope.
Now religion's on trial.
Can he really be sure what he saw?
Tickets back with a can't-miss episode next Friday.
That guy looks just like John Paul II,
too. I was like, they got the Pope?
That guy got cast in multiple shows to be the Pope.
I swear he's in Hot Shots, too.
Hot
Shots also as the Pope.
So there's that one where the Pope was witness to a murder. And then this other one.
Don't miss back-to-back episodes of Emmy's Best. Starting Thursday, a death in Rome. The only thing more shocking than who it is how it happened.
Spontaneous human combustion.
Then on Friday, when a doctor seduces a patient.
It was the equivalent of mental rape.
Will she get revenge? Back-to-back Picket Fences start Thursday.
What the
That was a weird
It is a
show.
Very weird show. I mean, they dealt with David E. Kelly is known for that too, of just like, oh, what's hot in the news now? Like, let's have a story about gay adoption. Let's have a story about a transgender person. Let's have all these. He'd have all these things. He wouldn't treat them with the most sensitivity, but it's a trashy network drama. Like, what do you expect? Like, I didn't expect nicer stuff than that.
Yeah, but it was like his other legal dramas, but much more offbeat and goofy.
Yes, yeah. I think it was kind of made in the shadow of Twin Peaks. Like, not similar to Twin Peaks, but of just like, middle America's weird. It's weirder than you think. Like, that kind of spirit. Mm-hmm. And also, for a couple seasons, Don Cheadle was on it in between being in movies. And also, they attempted David E. Kelly, they shared a production space with X-Files. And in the late seasons, he attempted with Chris Carter to do a crossover episode between X-Files and Picket Fences.
What?
But the networks were not cool with it.
Yeah,
like,
Picket Fences was
CBS,
CBS.
And X-Files was Fox. So they turned it down. And
That would have been perfect for them.
But they already wrote the script. So there's an episode of X-Files that just was a reworked Picket Fences crossover. And then an episode of Picket Fences where there's a FBI agent who comes to town who was originally Fox.
I was trying to cue normally on our shows we have the X-Files sound effect, but I don't have it handy.
Good
so
MIDI knockoff.
I couldn't. They're all like goofy versions of it. There.
Yeah, they're all like.
There you go.
But so Picket Fence's final episode ended with a big old happy ending and a triple wedding. They finally were just like, fine, these three couples you want to see get together, they all get married at the same day. And then another couple who was split up, they get back together at the wedding. So it's almost a quadruple wedding.
Jesus.
So big old happy ending. Then also technically on TV, but this is also for sports, the NBA draft was on June 26th, and the 1996 NBA draft is seen as one of the deepest / best drafts in NBA history. It had 13 future like all-stars in the first two rounds of it.
Give us some names?
Well, the number one, let's see that clip, is the number one draft pick.
With the first pick in the 1996 NBA draft, the Philadelphia 76ers select Allen Iverson from Georgetown University.
The second he said Sixers, I was like, I think I know where this is going.
Practice.
We're talking about practice.
Not a game. Practice.
Yeah, Allen Iverson, you know, a multi-time MVP of the NBA, I believe, and a big-time star. But even, I would say, even more famous, at least now, especially because he just ended his final season, Kobe Bryant is the 13th draft in it. Originally gotten by Charlotte, but would get a trade deal to put him on the Lakers, so he only ever played for the Lakers, I believe. But and also Steve Nash was in it as well. So these are all like three huge like all-timers in the same draft in 1996. That's why many NBA historians remember this as one of the best drafts in history.
Wow. Taking us out of the 90s, 1996 games, not a whole lot, but I don't know if, again, the dates for some of these things are difficult because no one was really paying attention and keeping track of some of this stuff. But Fade to Black, which was a follow-up to Flashback, which was Flashback I loved.
It's too hard for me.
Great animated, like 2D adventure game, kind of like Another World / Out of This World or the original Prince of Persia or Super NES Blackthorn. A kind of game where you're not overpowered. The odds are against you, and it's very much around platforming, sneaking around. And in this game, you lose your memory and have to figure out who you are. And it's this conspiracy of aliens that are slowly infiltrating government. And as a video game at the time, it was a very slow burn. And at a time when a lot of games were about moving quickly or beating bosses or jumping and bouncing around, or even at this point, you know, first person shooters, the idea of a game that was not that, especially on Super Nintendo and Genesis, was like, oh, neat. This feels different. This feels like Blade Runner or something.
Yeah.
And this was called Fade to Black. I could not get into it because it was a 3D game, polygonal game at a time when there was not really a 3D polygonal controller. The N64 is still months away, and the DualShock doesn't exist. You're trying to navigate with a D-pad, much like when RE1 came out. You're like, this is not good.
I remember really wanting to rent this game because it had a giant polygonal lizard on the cover with a gun. And I'm like, this looks amazing. Yeah. I want it. And then I think I did rent it. I'm like, this guy's slow and it's not fun.
I was really upset with it, and I think in reality people who stuck with it liked it, but I just at the time was like, this looks awful and it's clumsy, and I just could not get into it. But it is the same Conrad from the original flashback. He's in the year 2190, trapped in New Alcatraz in space. But, you know, I would not recommend Fade to Black necessarily. If you do, go to LaserTownPodcast.com, look on the 302010 page, and tell us in the comments. But I would recommend Flashback, not so much the HD enhanced remake reimagining thing it got a year or two ago. I would definitely try to find like the Super NES or Genesis version or Mega Drive if that's the way you lean. We'll head out of 96 with Eurythmics' Missionary Man.
Thank you.
Because it's on the Striptease soundtrack.
Really?
A decade later.
Wow. Oh, now I feel bad that I did my dumb singing version.
Along with
you
the Eurythmics, this was an on-the-fly change. As I was looking at the page, I'm like, wait a minute. This is much better. I was just going to play another KMFDM song. but it also has another Eurythmics song, Sweet Dreams. Most of you probably already know.
That's the one.
We'll go out with Missionary Man, and when we come back, what happened this week in 2006?
Don't mess with a missionary man. Missionary man, he's got God on his side. He's got the saints and apostles backing up from behind. Black eyed looks from those Bible books.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Internet and all the ships at sea. It's Diana's Classic Corner to see if there's anything farther back in time this week that's worth a watching. 75 years ago this week, we've got The Reluctant Dragon, June 27th, 1941. So again, 75 years ago this week. It's not entirely important. It's only interesting because it was a Disney film that came out while Disney animators were on strike. And so if you go look up photos of the strike, it's hilarious because animators make the best signs. Also, this kind of pushed Walt Disney into hating unions absolutely forever as part of a communist plot. Then 50 years ago this week, there was an odd movie I had to track down. It took me a while to see it. A Fine Madness starring Sean Connery and directed by Irvin Kershner, director of Empire Strikes Back. It's not especially good, but it is kind of hilarious to see Sean Connery back when he was James Bond as a poet. He's a modern day writer, and he's very drunk and disorderly, and he keeps yelling about people trying to steal his poems. That in itself, like, watch 3 minutes of it, is pretty funny. So because there's nothing I really want to recommend, I am going to. I really hope I'm not jinxing this because 2016 has been a horrible year for celebrity deaths. But come the end of the week, July 1st, Olivia de Havilland will turn 100 years old. Please make it a couple days, Olivia. We love you. You might remember her from, like, Gone with the Wind. She's really good. I will recommend two of her movies. 1938's Adventures of Robin Hood, which is one of her 9 movies she made with Errol Flynn. I recommend that one because it's my favorite. It's so colorful and goofy and fun, and the score is crazy, and the costumes are crazy, and they just have amazing chemistry. It's just so much fun. It's got a great sword fight. Adventures of Robin Hood is so great. On her own, I think her best performance is 1949's The Heiress. She's amazing in it. When you see something like Gone with the Wind with her, and you realize she's kind of like, that's like the role that she sort of played, where she's like a nice person who's really kind and sweet. And then in The Heiress, you start to see the range. You know, she's very withdrawn and quiet as this sort of like wallflower that this handsome guy is interested in, but is he interested for her or her money or what? And the change that the character makes over time is fantastic. Happy 100th birthday, Olivia de Havilland. Please don't die before this comes out. Anyway, that's it for this week. Stay classic.
Chaka 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 con. Chaka con. Chaka con. Chaka con. Chaka con. Let me rock it. Let me rock it. Chaka con. Let me rock it. That's all I wanna do. Chaka con. Let me rock it. Let me rock it. Chaka con.
Let me rock the rebel feel for you. Chaka Khan, what you tell me what you wanna do? Do you feel for me the way I feel for you? Chaka Khan, let me tell you what I wanna do. I wanna love you, wanna hug you, wanna squeeze you too. And let me take it in my arm, let me feel you with my charm, Chaka. Cause you know that I'm the one that keep you warm, Chaka. I make it more than just a physical dream. I wanna rock you, Chaka, baby, cause you make me wanna scream. Let me rock you, rock you.
2006's best song. That is Chaka Khan, I Feel For You. New this week in the sense only that this week, 2006, a platinum collection for Chaka Khan was released, which of course is going to include this song from the 80s, which is I'm making the John Cena finger A-OK.
He invented that.
He invented it in like circa 2002, 3, I think. Just what a great song. But that's one of those songs that is like been, I don't know, all three decades, because as a kid in the 80s, I remember hearing it around, and then in the mid to late 90s, when everyone, the world decided the 80s were okay to like again, especially 80s music, and it started to be like, oh, retro radio, like Saturday nights from 8 to midnight, we're going to play 80s songs, because they'd finally got over the hump of hard rejecting 80s sound with all the alternative, and
they realized the 80s fans were old enough now to be a demographic.
Yeah. And then I remember hearing it in high school all the time. And then now in 2006, this collection came out, and it's like, oh, man, this song is like, and now here we are 10 years since that, and it's still a really
Chaka
a song.
Khan's still cool, man.
It's such a great song. Cool. News this week, in 2006, the hellscape of this year, the most recent flag desecration amendment fails to pass in the Senate.
Yeah, this is the last time it's they've tried to. It's been on.
I won't be shocked if they try it again.
2006.
I won't be surprised if they try it again. I remember at my old job there was a young person joined the team, and she was like 24, fresh out of college, and we talked about like. She said, oh, can you believe it's even illegal to burn a flag? And I'd be like, no, it's not. Like, you can burn a flag if you want to. It's fine. And but she was like, no, I don't think you can. I had to Google it to prove it, because I think, you know, she's like 10 years younger than me. And I think in her age, she really grew up of like, the flag is the most sacred thing in the world. You can't do anything to the American flag. And
that's true.
It must be illegal to do something to it.
It's the W administration, and I guess that was probably their best shot. That's something I associate with his dad more. It's something from the fucking 70s.
Like, it's such a retro thing to be like, these flag burners, like, but it's not Nixon's in charge anymore. Like, what do you care about flag burning?
But yeah, it failed by one vote. It had to be agreed upon by 2/3 of the Senate, and it was off by one. It was 66-34.
I mean, in the shadow of 9/11 and the Iraq War, I could see there being a powerful push for it once more, like to get out. And an amendment to the Constitution is such a huge thing.
But also, like by 06, I think the pendulum was swinging the other way
a little bit.
If you wanted to get the amendment to for flag desecration, it's like you should have had that in like 02 when it would have like passed. Like,
yeah, they got the Patriot out.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
What a dark time. Sir, fortunately, we'll never be at a time where Americanism and jingoism destroys people's rights and freedom.
I kind of wish I had included a clip. Is it Mr. Show where
shit on the flag. Hey, look, burning the flag it's not cool, whatever. But I also, you know, it is your right to do it. That is a free speech thing. If you want to do it.
Yeah. I think my big problem is, well, what's a flag, though? I mean, I got a red, white, and blue bandana. It looks like a flag. Is it a flag? Can I burn it or not? Or
is Superman's uniform a flag?
What?
It's like, what a great segue.
I know.
What about us,
blue.
What about the plates I have for 4th of July? Can I not throw them out now because that's desecration?
Well, speaking of the American way.
You have great power. Even though you've been raised as a human being, you are not one of them.
It's not easy for me to live my life being who I am, keeping secrets.
Dad? God, are you there?
Clark, hey, welcome back. I see you've already met the Munchkin.
Hello. Yeah, well, you've been gone. Fearless reporter Lois Lane is a mommy.
Oh my goodness. Superman returns and finds out the world moved on.
What a weird. This is a companion to the last X-Men Last Stand chat from a few weeks ago.
Yes.
So this was.
This is a lot better, though.
It is. not great, but
not great,
but absolutely way better than Last Stand. But so 19 years it had been since there had been a Superman film in theaters.
And how long since a good one?
Well, 78 to that one. So yeah. 28 years.
We like Superman 2, right?
Yeah, Superman 2. Probably the last one.
The more I watch it, the less I like it, actually. Like, when all Zod can do is like, I will blow wind at you. Whoa! so bad. But, and also, I hate that an ending where, like, can we have a fist fight? Nah, we gotta just depower him and, like, drop him somewhere. Like, it, we can't have a special effects
throw
fist
him into
fight.
A Coke sign.
Anyway, though.
So Superman Returns.
Bryan Singer, though, loves the Richard Donner film. Like, yep. 1 and 2 are the only Superman films to him that matter, which is why Returns is a sequel to 2.
Right.
It pretends 3 and 4 didn't happen, and somehow now Superman is coming back from something. And so it is, Superman Returns is a total love letter to the Richard Donner films,
mm-hmm.
though the naming convention is connected to a year earlier, Batman Begins, Superman Returns,
mm-hmm.
like, which was also similar to The Man of Steel, The Dark Knight, similar reflecting naming conventions. Now, that also tells you what the fucking problem is with making Superman films after Batman became the more famous guy, is that the Batman films... Like, every Superman film has to be goddamn Batman. Like, and though this one, it's not really that it's Batman, because I'd say that was Man of Steel's problem, trying to make Superman Batman. This one's problem was trying to just have a 70s campy throwback type thing, but also deal with, like, the ideas of, like, Christ imagery.
Yeah, I was going to say, the problem is he's not trying to be Batman, he's trying to be Jesus.
There's also that. There's Christ imagery, there's weird campiness, and then also, like, gay stuff, too, as seen by the thing, like, I've got secrets, I can't tell you these things. And then on top of that, it kind of becomes Sleepless in Seattle, where Greg Kinnear's character is played by James Marsden as the other guy with Lois Lane, who... Like, he's competing with Superman.
It's such a weird movie on every level.
A lot of weird choices.
When I rewatched it, like, maybe 5-6 years ago, probably 8 years ago at this point, I was like, oh, this is really bad. Like, it doesn't make any goddamn sense. Like, super slow. Superman's a weird creeper who leaves and then comes back and just, like, hovers outside of Lois's house and spies
on
her.
That's creepy.
And it's like, you know, the weird, extra weird thing is you don't have to be outside her window.
Yeah.
You're Superman. You could do that from Wyoming.
I mean, within the film...
And you could still spy on her.
Within the film, there's a scene where he flies above Earth and is hearing all the cries, which, like, that's a great...
It's a cool scene.
There's some really cool Superman moments in here that you could finally see with the improvements in special effects from the last film. Like, the bullet bouncing off his eye.
That's cool.
Him catching a plane.
I love the opening. The plane is great.
The plane stuff is great. And him lifting up stuff. Like, his feats of strength are him, like, atomizing all the glass with his heat vision. And then catching the Daily Planet.
I feel like there are, like, there may be, like, too many scenes where he's just picking up a large thing and hoisting it into the sky. It's like...
That's also what I feel like. Man of Steel was a compensation for that, because this doesn't have a fist fight. Like, you'll see there are special effects set pieces, but he's got nobody to punch. When punching happens, it's because Superman's depowered and he's getting his ass kicked by goons.
Yep.
And then
on giant crystals floating in the middle of nowhere that Lex Luthor thinks people will pay billions for as real estate on the ocean. When it looks ugly and nothing will grow there because it's fucking alien crystal.
And so that's why I think Man of Steel is a reaction to that, of like, oh, you want to fight? We'll fucking punch for hours. you'll be sick of punching by that point. And Brandon Routh is fine, but I think he's fine.
He's doing a very, very good Christopher Reeve impression. Yeah,
I mean, that was his direction. Like, I'm certain Bryan Singer said, you do this. No, that's not Christopher Reeve enough.
Especially when he's Clark Kent. That Christopher Lee, Christopher Reeve is very nervous and sort of jittery.
Did he ever get another starring role in anything?
No, he's now on television as playing a different superhero, the Atom.
And his cameo in Scott Pilgrim was great.
That's the best. Loved it.
He went to kind of movie jail after this, even though it wasn't, like, a huge flop. It just was.
And it's not his fault.
And it's also famous for... The only thing I really remember from this is Kevin Spacey's, like, not good performance, but this one word.
This is fantastic casting.
Come on, let me hear you say it just once.
You're insane.
No! No, the other thing.
Superman will.
Wrong.
yeah. It's again. He's being very Superman Gene Hackman-y.
Yeah, like he's doing
he
a Gene Hackman.
Told to be.
Yeah. And that's good casting. He's someone who can do that.
Jesus, for years.
God. and you know that opening where they wanted it. They had a cameo of one of the old Lois Lanes.
Oh.
But she played the old woman who had had sex with Lex Luthor, who he then defrauded for money.
Oh. Yeah.
And but I guess at the core of this, that was the real problem with it. It made Superman a deadbeat dad.
Yeah.
And not only a deadbeat dad, the one who had sex with Lois Lane and then didn't tell her he's Clark Kent. Like, that's the one level. Like, that is a super deception there. Like, if
that's why he's Superman. Even his deceit is super.
If it's supposed to follow from two into this one, that's when he was depowered and had sex with her.
Yep.
And then at the end of it, he gives her a kiss, which erases her memory.
Yeah.
So when you put that into the subject of, like, so you had sex with her, you then erased her memory of that event without asking her, and then you come back and she's pregnant and she just assumes it's Superman's kid, that's really messy.
Even if he was depowered, the Sugar Hill Gang does warn against Super Sperm.
Yeah, Super Sperm, man. No, it's so messy and complicated.
I don't know
why open the door to that
with
your billion-dollar movie.
I don't understand why I put the kid in.
The kid sucks.
Kid's weird. He crushes someone with a piano in the movie. Good. The kid has powers.
Yeah.
This always reminds me, I don't know what the state of this site is anymore, but theeditingroom.com.
That was very funny.
Which was just like fun riffs on parody scripts of movies. And I remember reading this one around not long after this movie came out and just dying the whole time through this. Just taking this movie and raking it over, just burning it alive. And there's one that I love, this one scene where it's Brandon Routh and I guess his mom, who is Eva Marie Saint.
Yes.
Yeah. From North by Northwest, baby.
Good casting.
Eva Marie, which I just think of wrestling now. But it's like, Brandon Routh, mom, why am I thinking about my own origin story? Because Bryan Singer really just wanted to make a brand new Superman movie, complete with the origin story and all. He was worried that ignoring the previous Superman movies would somehow be disrespectful to Richard Donner and Christopher Reeve, so he just went through the screenplay and replaced all instances of arrives with returns. Brandon Routh. Oh, so that's why I left long enough for the world to forget about me. Well, I guess I'll go to Metropolis and get a job at the Daily Planet. I think you mean go back to Metropolis and get your old job back at the Daily Planet. And then the opening of this whole thing is the old lady. I'm leaving everything to you, Kevin Spacey. Because I provided you with love and affection? No, because I watched Beyond the Sea, and now I think you're Bobby Darin. Don't get me wrong. The sex was great. Thanks. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page, and there isn't anything subtle or ambiguous about this. I'm 90 years old, my pussy hangs to my knees, and your limp dick was inside it. You, the self-proclaimed greatest criminal mastermind of our generation, has gone from evil schemes like launch two nuclear missiles at once to eat out old wrinkled bitches. Kevin Spacey. Yep, we all get it. This is actually how the first Superman movie in 19 years is starting.
Yep.
Oh,
like, the
dear.
First scene of the movie, you're like, why is Lex Luthor the long con of getting with this old woman?
Hey, whatever.
But he is absolutely better than Jesse Eisenberg. That's for damn sure. And yeah, his plan of it's just more real just, estate plan.
The real
so,
estate.
No, but just the idea of like Superman and Clark Kent come back on the same day. Nobody notices.
Certainly. Why would they?
That's very silly.
Yeah, no. But I also do think his real estate plans, I think Kevin Spacey played it on the level that it could be read as like, no, he's a mass murdering sociopath who just likes to talk about real estate. And then when people bring up like, no, you're going to kill billions of people. Yep. Yeah. Going to do it.
Billions.
Billions. And Parker Posey is also like in a very campy, silly role too. But it's just blah.
Yeah, but at least it's got the John Williams score. God damn it.
Yeah.
You just listen to that over and over again. Go outside and try to fly as hard as you can.
And
don't jump off a building. Just stand out on the corner. And with that music in your head, you're totally going to think you can.
Through sheer will.
And Superman absolutely does a Christ pose in the film. Too, after being stabbed in the side.
Yes. Also out this week, The Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah.
I feel bad as the girl around here that I've not seen this.
I mean, hey, Meryl Streep is amazing in something.
I love Meryl Streep.
News at 11. Like,
I love Meryl Streep. I love Tucci. Mm-hmm. Anne Hathaway's cool.
Well, also, I'm surprised you haven't seen it. Well, none of us have seen it because it's also a journalism film. Like, it's about working at Vogue magazine.
Journalism.
Well, I mean, it is about being a writer. Like,
back when print jobs were still plentiful.
Yes. And it's about the boss from hell. That's who it is. And Anne Hathaway is real good in it, too. But
is there a literal devil or is it a... She's,
no, she's a horrible boss.
Dang it. I was hoping one of them would actually
based
be...
Based on a real-life person.
Yeah. Made $300 million on a budget of 30, so... Wow. Nice. They killed it with this.
And certainly after that, they never had to work hard to prove a female-led film could be released in theaters and make money.
As long as it's about shoes and clothes, I understand. And then after that was The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
Right. The Wind That Shakes the Barley is the movie. I had a choice of what movie I was going to watch this week. I watched this one because it won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival that year. It's a Ken Loach film about the Irish uprising, 1920, Anglo-Irish War, right before Irish semi-independence in the early 1920s. And I was going to bring a clip, but every clip of the movie is pretty much just get down, Irish scum. It's black and tans beating the shit out of people for like 2 hours. But it's interesting, like from a political standpoint, it's kind of an interesting look at, you know, revolutions are messy, and insurgencies are even messier. And
what if white people were insurgents, huh?
Yeah, it's same shit, different day, man. It's good. No, it's good. Cillian Murphy. And so it's Scarecrow and Davos Seaworthy from Game of Thrones. Those are your main characters.
Good cast.
Yeah, they're good.
And then TV.
Yes, television. Oh, well, actually, Dave picked this one out, the first one.
Yeah, so this was the season, it's two episodes, season premiere of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia season 2, which is notable because it was the first episodes including Danny DeVito. I mean, like...
A.K.A. Frank.
Yes, and Frank Reynolds. But yeah, the first season did okay in the ratings. It was like, you know, FX's like first real venture into comedy. I remember it was like, it was up with another show called Starved that like got canceled after the first season. The show was whatever, but then like once Danny DeVito came on...
I like the first season.
Yeah, like it was like thematically, the show did not change a whole lot. It was still like a bunch of dirtbag people doing disgusting things.
But Frank is such a dirtbag.
Yeah, he just
so
adds
disgusting.
To it.
He's
yes.
the filthiest dirtbag of them all, but he also is magically rich, so he can start storylines, too. I just be like, I bought a thing! It's this!
But yeah, so the very first episode he's on is called Charlie Gets Crippled. I have a clip from it. It's not a great debut for him, but...
Dennis, I need to borrow $20.
What, dude?
Just give me some money, man.
How come you don't ever have any money?
Hey, money's...
No way.
What are you going to do with this strip club?
Just get in the car.
No, it sucks for me, because you guys get all the girls and the...
Come on, my dad's going to be here in a second. Will you just get in the car?
No, I'm going home.
We go?
Yeah, we can go. We can go. Jesus.
He just teleports in front of the
car.
Well,
so that's another thing that, like, especially during the earlier seasons with Danny DeVito, like, his schedule did not work that well. So, like, they would film all of his stuff in, like, one shot and just, like, insert into episodes later. And a lot of cases...
Lucky to have him, man.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, like, especially that scene, it's, like, emblematic of, like, he is not in the shot with
them.
Yeah,
it's pretty...
He just shows up, like, in front of the car. Dennis!
Yeah. Also, that was encoded with the first MP3 encoder ever invented.
Jesus Christ,
I think
it did sound bad.
Yeah.
Sorry,
but I love the ads heading up to it though. It was sort of like meant for older folks like myself, like Grandma Di here, where they're like, "Hi, we got the show. It's got a goofy title. Oh, Danny DeVito, you're on it. Yeah. What was the last TV show you're on? Taxi.
Wow.
You should watch our show.
Yeah.
No, you. Fuckers, now I have to.
It's been a decade of Danny DeVito saying whores.
I've barely watched the show. I've seen like 3 episodes. But there was one point, like probably about a decade ago, where we were in a Taco Bell. I was back home in Illinois on visiting home. And somehow, like, the letters got transposed and it became It's Always Funny in Philadelphia. And then it was like, actually, no, it better be funny in Philadelphia, because if you're gonna name your town Sillydelphia, it better be funny. And that's all I can think of when I hear
hearing that old clip reminded me of how, like, in his introduction, Frank was kind of supposed to be like a force of normalizing for them, where he would just be like, "You guys went too crazy. I can't bail you out of this." Like, but by the, I think even the next year, he was like crawling around in couches with Charlie and just like being the filthiest gross person. And
yeah, sleeping in the same bed as his son.
Yeah, well, that's
having
also,
dumpster sex.
That's also by the third season they set up that he wasn't even Sweet D and the other guy's dad, like Dennis and Sweet D's dad. He was, but he was Charlie's dad, and the person who was really their dad was played by the Seventh Heaven. But yeah, I think it definitely led to a second act or a third or fourth act of Danny DeVito's career because a whole generation just knows him for being like just so filthy and disgusting on the show. And he's so fucking good at it. Like I kind of dropped off after season six with Always Sunny, but it was always such a funny show because they're the worst people. Everyone else they meet were the good guys.
Yep. And I do have to throw in for a move or for a show about dirtbags in Philadelphia, they don't have the correct accents.
Now, well, I mean, they film it in L.A. It's not in Philadelphia.
I mean, if you ever had media out there with an actual Philadelphia accent, people would riot. It's so terrible.
What did you think of the Philly accents in Silver Linings Playbook?
They don't have them.
Okay.
No. And, what's-his-face is even from my neighborhood, but...
He is, really? The handsome
what's
man?
What's his name? Yeah.
Handsome guy.
He's Jenkintown.
It's Always Sunny. Philadelphia is still good. I like a couple of episodes from this most recent season. There's like a first person episode completely from Danny DeVito's perspective.
Wow.
So just him doing disgusting shit, but you see it right up close. And then there's a ski movie parody episode that's also
great. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Ultimate Fighter 3 ended this week with Michael Bisping was the big winner in his bracket. But it would be 10 years before that British fighter would win his first UFC championship in the last month.
Yep.
Michael Bisping was the competitor on this. The season, I believe, is built around the Ken Shamrock Tito season,
I think.
Yeah, which, like, those guys...
Both, especially Ken Shamrock's way past his...
I mean, they were over the hill, neither of them, but they got to be, like, in kind of the senior league or just this special thing of, like, we'll fight each other three times for lots of money... Because we would each were big name guys who would each lose to current stars. We'll fight each other, so Michael Bisping just makes this one a little more important than most Ultimate Fighters. I'm gonna go to the bottom here real quick. With on June 28th, Blade the series premiered on Spike with Sticky Fingers, the rapper Sticky Fingers, playing the lead role. And it only went for one season, but let's hear a little bit of Blade the Vampire Hunter here.
Wage a war that has raged for thousands of years. A war that starts at sunset and ends at sunrise. A battle for the survival of the human race. Man and monster, hero and villain. Vampire and vampire slayer. My name is Blade.
Somehow not a KMFDM song in it.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, Spike doesn't have the budget for that. It was an attempt. It was an attempt to make a Marvel TV series before there really were a thing. And, Blade was pretty much over as a film series. Trinity did not do well and was a fiasco to make.
It was bad.
And so David Goyer, who was the writer and director of the third one, but had been working on Blade from the beginning.
One and two are so good.
He showrun and created the show, and the first episode is co-written with Jeff Johns, who is now, at the time already was a very accomplished comic book writer and Hollywood writer of some note, but he is now the co-man in charge of DC's films and television production, on top of making comics as well. But so, yeah, that's it only ran for one season, wasn't very well received. Rapper Sticky Fingers, as an actor, you might also know him as he played a rapper slash gang leader in the Shield, one of Brett and I's favorite shows. He was the one who, like, him and another gang leader were left in like a shed overnight to see if they could settle their differences, and he was the only one to walk out. He's like, yeah, I beat him to death in there. So that difference. the big one.
Yeah.
June 25th, late at night on Adult Swim, Venture Brothers Season 2 is back. Let's hear that theme song.
This is such a great show. despite loving this as much as I do. Whoa, the fanfare. Yeah. I still have not watched anything past 2011.
Well, that's only one season you're missing. So that I was shocked that it was 2006 when then the second season began because not to sound like a hipster, but I was into Venture Brothers from the beginning. Like they aired a pilot over Christmas of like 2003.
Yeah.
But then the series began in earnest. The first season aired in 2004.
Yep.
Created by Jackson Publick, who is a comic creator, and he had written for The Tick, both the animated series and the live-action one. He then pitched this show to Adult Swim, which was an adult parody of Johnny Quest, which really grew into so much more, and a parody of pretty much every nerdy pop culture thing of the last, like, 40 years.
Because even Johnny Quest, even as old as I am, I was like, I have no nostalgia for Johnny Quest, and it was not a thing. No one I knew, none of my friends talked about it. It was not a thing. But
he co-made the show with Doc Hammer as well. So and the show then kind of just turned into this, like, as if they've pitched it, a show about failure, about adults who have failed and who are just kind of like living in their misery or their compromised lives, but also who are superheroes or super scientists or super villains.
It's a great message to 20-year-olds. Who are heading into the 30s, or if you're 30 into your 40s, of like people who have seemingly achieved dreams or achieved fantastic feats, and it sucks, and that there's no victory in victory, and that even if you have a rocket car and a crazy base,
I don't
base,
even want to piss on this. I used to dream of pissing on this.
Yeah, just like what if you had a crazy Iron Man suit? So what? Like, what are you really in reality? What are you gonna do with it? And like, it's so mean spirited, but in a very entertaining way.
And this is the perfect example. I mean, first of all, the second season premiere is called Powerless in the Face of Death.
Yeah.
And
well, so it resolved. All right, so 2004, I watched the season finale.
Yeah.
And it ends on a cliffhanger of, like, the Venture Brothers, the lead characters.
I don't think it's a cliffhanger.
Well, yeah,
it's the end of Easy Rider.
Yeah, it's the end of Easy Rider, and they thought it would be their
last
episode.
They are shot and killed.
They are shot and killed. The Venture Brothers are dead.
Yeah.
Now, you know, at the end of 2004, fans were like, is there going to be a sequel? Are there going to be a second season? And I remember reading Jackson Publick's live journal and saying, it's in negotiations still, it's in negotiations. And so it wasn't until, like, months later that they even said, oh, we are making a second season. And production of that took a fucking year.
Yeah.
And so 2-year break in between seasons, which is pretty much par for the course for Venture Brothers. Mm-hmm. Like, it is a fine wine that is amazing every time it comes back. But it is also, like, the last season they just did was 8 episodes long. And I was like, this has been so great. And it's over already? Like, it's over already? I waited 2 years for this.
Yeah, the last season, the last episode I saw was in June of 2011 when, and I think even I was behind because I would only watch them on DVD when they would come out on cable. And at the time, they were not good about putting them online where you could actually watch them. And I'm not going to, my long stance is, I'm not going to go to the trouble to torrent your shit. I want to be that ignorant of it so that I can't even have a conversation about your show. I can't even continue the conversation. It will die when it hits me because you won't put it online somewhere where I can watch it. Anyway, it was the one where, like, it's the big, like, final prom night or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I think there's a season since then. And then
there's
there was
two seasons since then. But that does feel, it's a nice wrap up to the show.
It felt like it was over.
It had been canceled.
Yeah.
It could work as a finale, and many people thought it was going to be a finale at the time.
But I remember watching, like, in the lead up to this, because this is, again, as I've said earlier on the show, in 2006 at this point, I'd only been in California for like 4 or 5 months. Well, at this point, 6-7 months. Still didn't have a lot of friends, didn't have a lot of connections, lived in an area of town I still didn't know that much about, and would just watch TV all in weekend, and over and over would see, like, the teaser for this would be like, that time that you have been waiting for, this thing you've looked forward to your entire life, it is happening now, and the time that you will have been waiting for it will be over. And, like, just the way they would word it while that skull just slowly gets bigger and bigger, and I'm just like, I'm going to watch so much season 2. I can't wait. And then it finally came out, and it was great.
So they pulled a great sleight of hand trick with it, too. So they kill off the Venture Brothers, the leads on the show, in the end of season 1. Season 2 begins with a new opening that features their father and his brother in it to say, like, see, it's still the Venture Brothers. This is the new status quo, guys. And but then the show almost immediately rejects it in the episode, like, no, we're not the Venture Brothers. Get out of here. And it's then revealed that Hank and Dean were clones and that they die all the time because children should not be on Super Science Adventures because they're going to get killed.
Yeah.
And so...
Well, love that it starts out where, you know, you find out, oh, well, you know, that's an insurance policy because you're on these really dangerous missions. Mm. And then you gradually get to see a montage where sometimes they just kill him for shits and giggles.
Yeah,
they just think it's funny to make him, like, run into a jet engine.
Yeah, or him, or...
It's so horrible.
My favorite is when Hank jumps off a building dressed as the Batman and thinking he can fly. In there. But here's the explanation of how they were clones.
I'm going to tell my daughter.
Tell her what I tell everybody when this crap happens. The boys never die.
But they did. They shed their mortal coil as a snake sheds his skin.
Stop it. They are Hank and Dean. They have all the same memories, same annoying tendencies, same everything. Look, if you have a clumsy child, you make him wear a helmet. If you have death-prone children, you keep a few clones of them in your lab. Speak of the devils, their half-formed ears must be burning. Brock?
And they just look like piles of baby pink goo.
They're just pink. They're the size they would be, except all pink. And it's that would be the last time they actually died on the show, though. They would, and they'd later kill off all the clones, getting rid of that. But it's this season two, when it began, it was them realizing they'd have more seasons than just one, so there's a ton more world building in it, a ton more background being set up for characters, and they end on a more clear cliffhanger to the next season because they felt more comfortable in thinking there would be a next season. But it's a really great show. If you've never seen it, like, it's now been 12 goddamn years and they're finally up to like 50 episodes or something. So
God, some of the episode names, like, I know why the cage bird kills.
Escape to the House of the Mummies Part 2. Sorry, there was never
Escape
Part 1.
To the House of Mummies Part 2.
This is a great season. I'm looking through all the
Escape to the House of Mummies might be my favorite episode.
Guess who's coming to state dinner?
Alan's good too. There's so many great episodes on this one. But yeah, look it up, guys, if you've never seen it. And this was the second season. I also remember this week, I meant to mention it was Superman, but it's connected with both of these. This was like the first or second week I lived in San Francisco or in Berkeley, California. So
third season, now museum, now you don't.
That's good. But so I remember, like, I remember seeing Superman Returns by myself because I got in a fight with my new roommate that day. I was like, no, F you. I'm just going to go see a movie. We'll talk later.
Surely you were going to go see it anyway.
I mean, I was, but I was just like, you know what? I'll see it now because I'm mad at you. And I definitely, certainly, like, grumbled the whole time on my way there and was distracted watching the movie. And then with Venture Brothers, we didn't have a TV. We were living in her studio for a week before we moved into the two-bedroom place we'd share later.
Jeez.
But we were friend roommates, guys. But anyway, so...
Yeah, but two people in a studio is always horrible.
Oh, you can see why we got in fights.
Yep.
Though also, like, being roommates with somebody you're not having sex with, it's just like, you can't
have sex.
You can't get over a fight by making up in any real way. You're just like, fine, I'll just bury this anger.
Sorry, man, let me make you an omelet.
But anyway, so since she didn't have cable or a television, I instead went to... Adult Swim was starting to stream their stuff new on their website at that point. So I went to a internet cafe and used one of their computers to watch it on their, like, old ass computer. It was fun at times.
Well, games this week suck. Notably, I reviewed because I like jets, planes, aircraft. This flying game called OverG Fighters, which I think is one of the lowest scores.
It's an OverG fighter and a bona fide stud. And you can't teach that. I'm sorry, it was wrestling.
We almost made the whole show. One of the worst flight games I've ever played. It was published by Ubisoft before they went down the road with Hawks.
Huh.
So it was interesting that they, like, it wasn't developed by Ubisoft, but it was just like, it's weird knowing that they would go to Hawks even after they had what had to be a bomb. because it did not review well. Like,
it
I was
have told them, like, oh, these don't sell. We tried to publish a flight game and nobody bought it.
But like, Ace Combat was still doing okay because 6 would come out the next year, and it was, you know, I was like, I want to play because Xbox 360 was still new at this point. There was no PS3, there was no Wii, so 360 was the next gen machine. So of course I want to play a flying game, and it was just really bad. But that's the end of the show.
Woo!
Thanks for your support at patreon.com/lasertime. That's how this show was unlocked originally, years ago.
We
started the show in January. We've been going week by week ever since, encapsulating what has happened. You can find out more at lasertimepodcast.com or follow on Facebook, Twitter, all that good stuff.
And you know, there's tons of other great stuff you'll find at lasertimepodcast.com, including the original podcast that started it all, Laser Time, where we take a given subject in a week and deconstruct it as thoroughly as possible, such as talking about Pink Panther insulation or old media that we don't use anymore or superheroes that have premiered in the last 30 years.
And the show is brought to you because of funding from Patreon, patreon.com/lasertime. We have a weekly bonus show called Bonus Time. It's another hour full of audio clips and us joking around. But also, at the $5 level, we do a weekly live movie commentary along with all of our patrons called The Monday Night Movie. And we did Labyrinth as one of those movies, so you can listen to the archive of that.
Oh, and there's Talking Simpsons, our weekly deconstruction of every episode of The Simpsons from the beginning. We always talk about The Simpsons on here, but that's because our brains are filled with Simpsons knowledge, and we must share it one episode at a time chronologically. And the first season of that is available exclusively on patreon.com/lasertime.
And if you like video games, my husband does Video Game Apocalypse, which is just about video games, and it doesn't have to go just week by week where we're like, and this week, yeah, nothing happened. It's only the good parts.
So sometimes no over G rider or whatever.
No, definitely not. That brings us to the final segment of the show.
Oh,
the birthday segment. And again, home movies, the birthday song. This clip has 69,000 views, and I have to be half of them at this point. This week in famous birthdays, June 24th through the 30th, the first half of this is really stacked with specific star types of stars. Mindy Kaling, Angela Kinsey, Nick Offerman, Ricky Gervais.
Wow.
Yeah. All in the same...
NBC lot is...
Parks and Rec office stuff. George Michaels.
Oh, okay.
That regular one. George Michael?
The real one, quote unquote. Anthony Bourdain, Derek Jeter, Chris O'Donnell, Helen Keller, Toby Maguire, J.J. Abrams, Felicia Day, Mel Brooks, and The Quiz. Born in 1948. Recently an American Horror Story. Nominated for an Oscar for a famous role that would really give it away. Was also in Blindside and About Schmidt.
Kathy Bates. Oh, Kathy Bates.
There you go, Kathy Bates.
Academy Award winner for Misery, thank you.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Winner, not nominated.
Winner.
Nominated
Earned
and
it.
Winner for Misery.
I love Kathy Bates. She's great.
She's great.
Yeah.
But taking us out, it would be irresponsible to not play Magic Dance from Labyrinth, a great David Bowie song with a babe with the power, what power, power, judy voodoo. We should play that as we leave. When we come back next week, what happened again 30, 20, 10 years ago?
What kind of magic spell to use?
Slime and snails.
Or puppy dogs failed.
Thunder or lightning.
And baby said...
Dance, magic, dance.
In 9 hours and 23 minutes, you'll be mine.